This is Mark Steiner, and welcome. I want to remind you, you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA, where support is provided in part by Mini Coupe Hardtop. Information available at miniusa.com/special offers. And as we jump into our conversation, let me talk about the anniversary of in the world today, what happened in our history. In 1944, this is when D-Day happened, that began to end World War II. Dwight D. Eisenhower, who commanded our forces, landed on those beaches in Normandy. British, Canadian, American forces and a million Allied troops hit those beaches and stormed those beaches. And some of our fathers, like my father, was there that day and survived to go on to conceive me. So we want to remember that. In 1962, the Great Algerian War that we read about and we talked about in this program before in our history segments exploded with the French slaughtering Algerians who stood up to fight back for their independence. That was the beginning of that. This was also, oddly enough, in terms of our cultural history, the day that the One Piece bathing suit was released in 1923 and became huge because laws were passed not to allow women to wear these bathing suits because they were deemed too provocative. And did not want women wearing one-piece bathing suits on our beaches. This was also the day in 2002 that President George Bush created the Department of Homeland Security, a constant source of angst for many people. Some people say very necessary. Shows have done about that as well. And this was also, again, let me, the one birthday I want to acknowledge today is the birthday of someone who had a huge effect on the on African American music and on music in America, people could probably something we don't think about, is the daughter of I just lost where I was going. Yes, and she became one of the leading figures in creating music and was the first person to in African American world to have her work recognized by the National Education Association. So this is one of these days we remember her. That'll be on our website, so you can look at the work that she's done, and see what the work she's done in our history. But now, let me just see what I just did here, and let me bear with me 1 second. Booker T. Washington's daughter, Portia Washington, we are talking about. I'm sorry. So just my computer messed up is what happened. I couldn't read what I tried to write down to tell you all. But let's jump into our conversation. There was a report that came out that we heard on National Public Radio and on our sister show, Tell Me More, with Michelle Martin. The NPR Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Harvard School of Public Health, African American Lives Today study that came out. Matt Thompson, who is editorial project manager for National Public Radio's, who helped conduct the study, joins us. Matt, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here, Mark.
Dr. Arvi Toltson joins us by phone, associate professor of counseling psychology at Howard University, editor-in-chief and contributing education editor of the Journal of Negro Education. And Dr. Toltson, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Dr. Kimberly Moffitt is with us in the studio, assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC, author of the book Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Always. And Keith Snipes, actor, writer, commentator, joining by phone as well. Keith, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Mark.
And all of you, join us at 410-319-8888. So, Matt, tell us first, give us the beginnings of the study. How did you approach this? Why did it occur? What were you looking for?
The last time that NPR partnered with Harvard to survey this audience was back in 2002. And we thought that given a few environments, environmental variables, the economy, the lingering impacts of the recession on African Americans, we thought that it would be a nice time to sort of take the temperature of Black America and talk to about 1,081 African Americans about a bunch of things, everything from their finances, their health, their hopes for their children, their dating lives and family lives, their communities, and more.
And I just got a note about you, Matt. It said we should change your title to the Manager of Digital Initiative and Mischief with NPR. Is that true?
That is right. That is true. That's what's on my business card. So.
I'm glad to see NPR is getting a sense of humor. among other things. But there were a lot of questions through this report, and let's just kind of look at them, some of the issues that people raised. I'm curious. I'd like to see what our guests kind of saw from these reports first, the things that stood out to you, and we'll kind of parse through them. Dr. Ivory Tolson, what jumped out to you as things you'd either question or amazed about in this report?
I think amazed would be kind of a strong word for me to describe anything. There was nothing that really surprised me in the report. I thought overall the report really remained above the surface. But it does give us the opportunity to think a little bit more deeply. But the report itself doesn't go very deep. But some of the things that I thought was things that we need to think about is the fact that black families right now have a pretty fragile existence as it relates to the economy today. There's a lot of unemployment. There's a lot of uncertainty about the future of finances. But another thing that the report found was that there was an enormous amount of faith in the black community, too. So despite the fact that there was some very real concerns about their economics, there was also this hope and this faith that things would get better. And I think that's because of black people's religiosity, spirituality, and our reverence to a higher power.
Dr. Moffitt.
I would agree, but I want to add that there was much about the report that I found that I was skeptical of or even nervous about because of some of the generalizations made. What I will say in a very lighthearted way is clearly for single women who live in the South and in urban areas, life can be real good because based on the report, you know, black women have greater opportunities to find men who are interested in being committed relationships. Finances seem to be strong and good. They're very impressed with school systems as well as believing that racial discrimination is of a minimum to them. So that says a lot about that particular population, but that's on the surface level. And I think if we explore these issues at a deeper level, that some of the generalizations can be quite dangerous.
And that's where I want to jump right into. So before I go to you, Keith, Matt, we only have like 4 or 5 minutes left with you. So that is one of the critiques of this report, that people felt, especially around issues of facing racial discrimination, issues of wanting long-term committed relationships, that it was kind of, in some sense, counterintuitive. And also people thought perhaps skimming the surface. And people were questioning, like one of our Dr. Menzies, who couldn't join us today, said, I'd like to know who they surveyed, because it doesn't seem full enough. What are your responses to that?
Yeah, one of the both good points and bad points about a poll like this, where we're asking about every aspect of people's lives, is that on the one hand, it offers many intriguing findings, things like that finding that single black men told us that they were significantly more likely to be seeking a long-term committed romantic relationship than single black women. But on the other hand, it doesn't give you the conclusions. You can't infer any conclusions from the study. I think it said a lot of, even when talking about the way people feel about their finances, there was a lot of really interesting response that the survey managed to capture about the study split about half and half between folks who felt that their finances were in not good or bad shape and folks who felt that their finances were actually pretty good. They were excellent or good. And that split, if you dig into the half of the respondents on either side of that split, you find that they have very different pictures of everything from their community to the air quality in their neighborhood to their safety from crime to their children's schooling and more. So a study like this offers intriguing findings that we certainly want to follow up on with further research and reporting. In some ways, we can also compare it to other available data, but it's one of the both strengths and weaknesses of a general survey. We hear about everything from life satisfaction to children, but we don't get to hear the conclusions about any of them.
So then what for you was the purpose of the study, if you say in some ways that it kind of really didn't, there could be a lot more to what we've learned?
So we like to do both things. So earlier this year, for example, NPR partnered with the Harvard School of Public Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to do a poll about childhood obesity specifically. So we dove in that case into one issue that does affect African Americans disproportionately, and we're able to find a real interesting goldmine of sort of data about how this phenomenon was playing out in people's lives. But the purpose of a study like this is it gives us a foundation on which to base further research and reporting. And it allows us, in some cases, to take a narrative that might begin to be coalescing. For example, that narrative that black men are perhaps more commitment phobic than black women, and offer some data that suggests that that might not actually be so.
So how much time, Matt, you have to run, is that right?
That is right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate that. And we'll just talk about you in your report in your absence.
thank you very much for having me. And don't be too harsh.
All no, right, we will not be, of course. Good to have you with us. Thank you, Matt.
All right. Bye-bye.
Matt Thompson, of course, helped author this report. As he calls himself now, the manager of Digital Initiative and Mischief at National Public Radio. Let's talk about what mischief this report may or might have caused. And Keith, we haven't heard from you yet. I apologize. Go ahead.
Well, I guess what stuck out for me, Mark, in that report is that happy quotient. You know, it historically combining happy and black in America has been at best ambiguous. So, you know, I wondered, my first question was the question you just posed, and I'm sorry I'm at a bit of a handicap being over the telephone. I wasn't able to really hear clearly what a person who actually was part of the report was saying. But my first question, the question that popped out for me was, what is the purpose of this kind of report besides its academic value? Is it for the purposes of gleaning for policy? Is it what is the purpose of this report, and why the focus on happiness, particularly in the context of an embattled black community as it is at this current time.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this conversation, on this report that has come out from NPR and the School of Public Health at Harvard in terms of the kind of state of black America, the mindset of black America, really. Is what this report kind of is purportedly looking at, and let's talk about what Keith picked up, and then talk about what this report really says to you beneath just these numbers. When we talk about the general overall happiness and satisfaction, 82% say they are satisfied with the area in which they live. Just under half, 47% reported that most of all the people in their area or black or African American. How does this fit into the reality of other statistics and what we know, Ivy Tolson, about the black world?
I'm not sure, and you know, I want to echo some of the concerns that a lot of people have had, and I feel compelled to say this as a researcher at Howard University, not Harvard, but Howard.
Yeah.
there are. People, both black and white, who have dedicated their lives to studying and understanding black people, and the research that they do gives a bit of nuance to it that helps us to delve deep into those issues and concerns that black people have. The authors of this report are not among those groups of scholars. And so, you know, you get what you get. You know, as far as survey research, you know, you have a group of people who make telephone calls to somebody. And so, you know, you're not sitting in a room with them. You haven't developed much of a rapport with them. I'm not sure how their voice sounded. I'm not sure if the caller was able to pick up on the fact that they were from a different community, from a different ethnicity. And someone who may have been, just not being sure of the true motives of the study, it doesn't surprise me that people might color their experience a little bit more. I mean, who wants to tell a stranger especially a stranger that doesn't sound familiar to them, that there are some problems that's going on. So it's hard for me to really, take this survey as an indicator of Black happiness. But I do think that, it can give us an indication of their faith and their resilience and the fact that Black people, regardless of their circumstance, they're going to try to make the best of it. And they're we're not the type of people who's just going to sit back and say that things are bad, woe is me. They're going to try to create an environment for themselves and in their own minds that they can be happy with.
And you questioned, Keith, I know you questioned happiness. I'm curious how you saw this, the first, Kimberly, this whole question.
I think happiness quotient is a really interesting one because, again, those three areas that seem problematic for me really lend itself or it counters quite a bit of anecdotal information that we have and even some of the research that we know of. And I know in the edited volume we did on Barack Obama and his effect, the Obama effect, one of the things that stands out is this continued effect that he seems to have on issues of race relations in the country. And so the fact that we have a number of African Americans who are commenting on the shockingly low numbers of experiencing racial discrimination, I think it lends itself to this whole idea of an Obama effect, that we've got a particular person who is the face of America and is leading our country that looks like the person that, we are. And as a result of that, there's this tendency to accept and believe that things have shifted in a great way, that we're not experiencing racial discrimination at the same heightened levels that we may have in previous generations, and certainly in comparison to the 2002 study. And I also think a lot of that has to do with this whole idea of kind of covert versus overt racism, or what even Patricia Hill Collins refers to as new racism, right, where it has this very subtle influence upon us that if it is not egregious and overt to us, someone called us the N-word in a very negative way, as an example, then we don't respond to it as though it might be racial discrimination. And we then explain away the behavior as being something other than race.
So, and Keith, when you mentioned the question of happiness, I'm going to come back to the what Kimberly was just talking about here in just a moment. But some people could argue that, look, this is that when you say satisfied and happy, that could mean more than just being dealing with discrimination and racism and issues of white supremacy in America. That happiness could be family.
Absolutely.
That happiness could be your church. That happiness could be, that I'm looking at life in a positive way. I mean, it could be, and I'm not talking about the Walt Disney zippity-doo-dah. I mean, this is, that it has deeper meanings, and maybe that's part of what this thing didn't explore, Keith, because it maybe didn't go under it enough, because people sometimes answer on the surface.
Well, and I think that's true. I think they do answer on the surface. And the guest that spoke before, Dr. Moffitt, I agree that we are not the kind of people who are going to say, woe is me. But I don't think we're the only ones who are that kind of people. I think that's what it means
right, to
be an American, to be perpetually optimistic. It's part of what allows the things that should be confronted to go unconfronted, if that is a word. And with this notion of optimism in the face of a really, really increasingly difficult conditions, I think that it provides a kind of false sense of well-being and might even suggest that not much needs to be done in the way of resistance to the reality of our current condition. So I was really bothered by the idea that it was put in this context of happiness. It almost seemed a frivolous to me.
Ivory Tolson, before you have to run, and we're going to bring Dr. Jeff Menzies in from the Urban Institute here at Morgan State University. I'm curious if you had that same reaction to this report that Keith Snipes just did.
think that I summed up my reaction pretty well. I even reached out to one of the people who puts in the methodology. But, you know, I deal with large data all the time.
Right.
And I think that, and a lot of the data that I deal with, I know it's not collected by people who may have a certain connection or kinship to the people where they would get the best type of disclosure. But, you know, when you have a large sample, it does give you a little bit of insight into some things. And there were, you know, some things that I thought were telling, you know, the fact that crime still stands out as a prominent issue in the minds of Black Americans, even though crime rates overall among Black people have gone down tremendously since the peak of the late 1980s, early 1990s, notwithstanding certain hot spots like Chicago.
Right.
But overall, you know, like in D.C., our crime rate was the lowest it's been since the 1960s. But yet, it's still in the forefront of people's minds. And I think from someone who's interested in school issues, I think that the perception that crime is a Black issue is influencing the way that our children, our Black kids, are being treated in school. They're put in a real high security environment when perhaps not warranted, but it's because of those perceptions.
Right, and I think that in many ways, and especially what you just said about the issues of crime, our next segment in the next hour is going to be focusing on that because it has to do with that perception, is partially because how the system fuels it. If you know, and who gets arrested for what, and what creates this kind of atmosphere. But one of the things this report said, while the problems common in African communities may dominate, while the problems in African communities may dominate the national discussion, the majority, 82%, say they're satisfied with the area in which they live. But it says just under half, 47%, report that most or all the other people in their area are Black or African American, while 51% say some, just few or none, are African American. Does that fit in with the real statistics of where most African Americans live in America? I mean, I'm not sure
who that question is directed to, but you know, I think that we can use better data sources than this survey to figure that out. But you know, the landscape of the United States is still pretty segregated.
And yeah. It's also important, I think Dr. Tolson is raising a key point where he talks about working with large populations or large inns in his research, whereas this inn is just over 1,000 or just shy of 1,100 people. And so
when that's a small sample.
That's
of something
a very
like this.
Small sample to speak to the entire Black population in this country at, what, 16%.
And the class sample was skewed.
Yes.
It seemed to me.
Yes.
But we have to take a break here. And I do want to come back to one of the most contentious pieces of report for many people, which has to do with relationships and what people are looking for. And how maybe this report showed similarities with the rest of America and maybe showed that there's not that much difference between communities in terms of attitudes. And we can look at that as well. And I want to thank Dr. Ivory Tolson. I know you have to run. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. Associate Professor.
Thank you. Thanks the rest of the guests.
Great to have you here, Editor-in-Chief and Contributing Education Editor of the Journal of Negro Education and Associate Professor of Counseling Psychology at Howard University. Dr. Jeff Menzies from the Urban Institute here at Morgan will be joining us when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back. We continue our discussion here about the new National Public Radio Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Harvard School of Public Health study, African Americans' Lives Today, that has caused a lot of controversy among a lot of commentators and a lot of thinkers. We were joined by one of the authors of that study from NPR earlier, and we still have with us here Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Assistant Professor of American Studies at UMBC, who wrote the book Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. Keith Snipes, actor, writer, commentator, who joins us often. We are also now joined by Dr. Jeff Menzies, who's a research associate here at the Institute for Urban Studies at Morgan State University. And Jeff, good to have you back with us.
Hello.
Hi, Jeff, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, hi, we got you. We know what was going on. They sound like honking horns. Were you? Maybe that was you. Maybe that was your comment. I don't know. But
yeah, that's what I think, man.
So, Jeff, one of the things that Kimberly Moffitt and I were talking about during the break, it was this, you know, that who gets polled and how, and there's all these questions that are always raised about that, especially when larger white institutions poll communities of color anywhere in America. But B, the whole question, one of the things Kimberly Moffitt raised was she really questioned how people would give school systems a B when you're talking about urban areas. Who answers the question with a B, given how where most of our city schools are in the United States of America? Your thoughts, Jeff?
Well, you know, first of all, what does a B mean? What does an A mean?
Right.
There's nothing qualifying any of these responses. I'm looking at this stuff, satisfied. What do you mean satisfied, man? reports like this, they trip me out. They feel like we were all getting along just well. I'm saying that, you know, tongue in cheek.
Yes, I hear you.
You know, we're sitting here in this high-level meeting, and all of a sudden somebody opens the door and throws a bag of marbles across the table. And we're all like, stop the press. Everybody stop what you're doing. Marbles are on the table. And now we're all trying to figure out, what are these marbles? Why did the person throw them on the table, and what's the meaning behind them? And I'm wanting to kind of say, I don't think it has much meaning, man. We're looking at these numbers. We're looking at all these statistics. 49% of African Americans are financially satisfied. And then you turn around and say, but 45 or more say they experience racism in their life. I don't know any sane person who is experiencing racism to say that they're satisfied with life. You see, and so to me, it's an issue of defining these terms. It's an issue with really understanding what they are talking about. And I don't think that many of the people surveyed understood. And I'm not speaking to their intelligence or anything of that nature, but I don't think that they understood globally, you know, what these questions were really trying to address. Like, for example, Mark, you can survey me and say, hey, Jeff, do you like hot dogs? And I say no. And here you go, oh, 100% of Jeffs don't like hot dogs. Right? And then from that, you don't know why. Is it because, you know, of what they're made of? Is it because I'm a vegetarian? Is it because of the health risk? What is my reason for responding the way that I respond? You know, and we have none of that with this survey.
Let's see what our listeners are thinking. We jump in here at 410-319-8888. Robert, you're on the air. Robert, you're on the air?
Yes.
Hi. Welcome. Turn down your radio, please, Robert, so we can hear you better.
Oh, okay. Hold on one second.
Sure. All right. Well, welcome, Robert. What do you have to say?
Okay. Hello?
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Of course, I also wondered, you know, what sort of reactions a predominantly black audience would give to researchers from Harvard. But I guess I have another question regarding, maybe it's methodology, maybe it's philosophy, not sociology. But I'm wondering about some other things. How much did they figure for, let's say, how the questions... the responses to the questions resembled or differed, let's say, along maybe class lines, generation, and I guess gender things. In other words, for example, what did they hold for that? Did they look at that? And also, I guess I wonder what proportion of the people to ask. I mean, were they mainly working class people? Were they mainly middle or upper class people? Were they urban folk? Older generation, millennials? There's a lot of things that would also be part of the mix in trying to figure out what all this means.
So, and Kim, we were talking about that. I think that one of the things reading this report it's hard to understand in terms of the methodology how we define middle class. I think they said 44% of the people who were surveyed were from the middle class majority in urban areas, right?
Right. Yes.
So I mean, in defense of how we define that, even that notion of middle class.
Because I could have middle class values, but I may not have middle class money.
Right.
So it really depends on how you understand class in your own head. We also know that 56% of the respondents were female, and we also know that in terms of school and educational attainment, that 51% of the population received a high school diploma or less.
Those are the stats today in the African-American world, you're saying?
No, that's according to who.
Right.
Yes, the respondents. Right. The respondents.
I'm sorry, is that you, Keith?
Yes. I think this report, while it quite frankly, I think it's laughable. And every time I've attempted to put on my serious hat and read the report, I ended up laughing. Because, I mean, one of the funny outcomes is that people are satisfied with schools. So I would think that if it has anything to do with class, then maybe we're talking about upper middle class respondents who, to a large extent, have their children in private schools or some alternative schools. Because we can't possibly be talking about an urban community that has their kids attending public schools.
It is
unconscionable to believe that a group of folk who were polled that have their children in public schools say that they're satisfied with the schools. That doesn't make sense to me.
And I think Kimberly. Keith is right, which is why I mentioned the point of the last grade of school that the majority of the respondents completed. And again, 51% are high school graduates or less. And so in terms of what our expectations are of schools might reflect our own educational experiences. So, I mean, because certainly in a course that I teach, to get a B means you really worked hard and you have earned something to actually receive a B. So the fact that we would say that any urban setting is worthy of a B is, as Keith has said, laughable because there's nothing that substantiates that information, especially when we start looking at and breaking down our community and looking at what is happening with our young black boys in urban districts who are being pushed into special ed classes or being medicated for behavior issues and not performing well academically at all, so that we then have an output of a lot of young men that finish school, if they choose to finish, who aren't citizens that can contribute very productively to our society. So there's nothing about any of our public school systems in urban areas that would be worthy of a B.
So we lost.
One other point I wanted to jump on. If you look at the top concerns of African Americans, health concerns, you see cancer, diabetes, stroke, high blood pressure, all obesity, all things that are related to diet, right? All considered to be preventable diseases. But then if you jump down and you start looking at the questions regarding the availability of fresh fruits and vegetables. Now, we all know of the concept of food deserts. But here we have people giving, as you're saying, Doctor, an A. 39% of people give an A for the availability of fresh fruits and vegetables. 31% B. And I'm looking at this, and I said, that's virtually impossible, you know, for any urban setting, any place, you know, that is predominantly occupied by African Americans, for there to be an excellent rating on the availability of fresh fruits and vegetables. Right. And then so I'm looking at this, and I see totally skewed. I mean, I'm not saying anything intentionally being done, but just the sample that they selected, the relatively small number of people polled, and for this thing to be given such grand review as some type of official report. My suspicion is that it's because who sponsored it.
Absolutely.
Is behind the report.
Absolutely.
Why I'm getting such high praise. But this thing is, it's, as you said, Brother Keith, laughable. It really? quality of drinking water, air quality. People are giving A's and B's. What makes drinking water a quality? You know, what gives it high quality? Ask that question, and most people will go mute.
So one of the things before we come out here, I want to get another caller. We only have a few minutes left, but we didn't really dive into one of the most controversial pieces of the report, which had to do with long-term relationships, that one-third has said of these young to middle-aged singles said they are currently seeking a long-term romantic relationship. But the biggest pieces here were that men, they said men are more likely to say they are looking for a committed relationship, 43%, than women, 25%. And nearly all, so that we were talking about, Kimberly, before, when the air is kind of also kind of flies in the face of most of our anecdotal lives.
As much that tells us, right, anecdotally, that black males seem to be commitment phobic, which is why I started my comments about being nervous of generalizations, because even though Matt Thompson said, you know, this isn't meant to be definitive, we're not making conclusions, but one of the primary points that is given to us under the social life category says many are not looking for long-term relationships. But then we have this stat that suggests that black men are more likely to look for such committed relationships. So we're getting seeing the two polarities of the same issue, not understanding what might be at the heart of why men might be drawn to this versus women? Or is it, in fact, that just who they happen to poll, women are having certain experiences and choosing not to look for committed marriage, committed relationships? Because what's also interesting is for that particular question, the survey asked African-Americans between the ages of 18 and 49 who were divorced, widowed, or never married about this whole institution of marriage.
Right.
And so by virtue of who you are talking to
right.
might
right.
influence why women are responding the way that they
divorced
are.
Divorced or never married. May say a lot.
for the guy to say that this is not meant to be conclusive, to me is similar to the creators of the synthetic weed saying, well, this stuff was never meant for human consumption anyway. You know, it's kind of like that fail-safe back door. It's like, hey, no, we put this out there, but by no means were you supposed to take this to be representative of everybody, although we said African-Americans. Males tend to, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's confusion.
Mark, I would never.
Keith, Jeff, let me just jump in. I want to let Keith get a final word in before we have to go to break.
Yes, sir.
I would never try to take away what sounds like a virtue for black males. I mean, it's rare that one is published nationally. But I just find this report to be, it's really nebulous. It has no basis in reality. I mean, if I took a poll amongst the people I know and divided that poll between male and female, I really do think that most of the women would likely say that they're looking for long-term relationships.
Right.
Well,
the men would probably say it to the extent that they want to look virtuous. But I'm simply being honest about it.
Well, or as Kimberly said before we went on the air, I have to leave now, but she said it, actually men might be answering that because they are served better by relationships than women often. So we just don't know it until we get there. So but I want to thank all three of you. Keith Menzies, great, always great to have you on the show, Research Associate at the Institute for Urban Research. Thank you for joining us here, and I know you had a busy day calling in. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Assistant Professor of American Studies at UMBC, and Keith Snipes, actor, writer, and commentator. Good to have all of you with us, as well as Dr. Ivory Tolson earlier from Howard University.
Thank you.
Thanks,
poor NPR. They just always get in the neck when it comes to race issues. Oh, well, what does that say? Maybe that's another topic for another day. We'll get to that one, though. Thank you all so much. We're going to take a brief break and talk about another stunning study that came out, The War on Marijuana in Black and White. Billions of dollars wasted on racially based arrests. Nothing we'll be surprised about, but here are the stats to back up what we think we know. Stay with us.